is F.
And he screwed it up again. Simon Marks there with the news. Thank you, Simon. How you doing there? You well? It's Thursday's Richie Allen show. With me, Richie Allen. Who else? Welcome to it. Good to be with you.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Welcome, welcome. I think the release of the transcripts of the Ghislaine Maxwell deposition, which took place back in 2016, I think a lot of people are disappointed this afternoon with the revelations. There aren't many revelations, really. Anyway, how you doing? John Waters, the Irish journalist and author, returns to your Richie Allen radio show. He'll be with me in the second hour. Ireland enters a six-week lockdown nationally until December 1st. John will talk to us about that and more. Before that, we're off to Chicago. The lovely Stephen Lendman will be there. We'll talk about the United States election, of course, on November 3rd, only 12 or so days away. We'll also get into allegations by intelligence agencies of election tampering by Iran and Russia. Surprise, surprise. Stephen Lendman will join me this hour. Ah, sure, be Gara and be Jesus and me shamrocks. How you doing? Not too shabby myself, I've got to say. Sure, I'm still alive. Rule one every day is wake up. Rule one, wake up. Love that Borat story and Mayor Rudy Giuliani and the sting. Are you following that? Giuliani has described it as a fabrication. The scene in the new Borat film, which apparently shows Giuliani sticking one of his hands down his undercrackers. I don't know what's going on. You can read about these things if they interest you on the interweb. So you can. We'll get through quite a bit. I'll tell you what we're not going to talk about today, because I can't be arsed. Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, has found more billions of pounds to keep businesses in limbo for the foreseeable future. I'm not going to get into that. You know my feelings on it. And if you want the details, you again, get onto Tintinet and put in Rishi Sunak and read all about it. Read all about it. I'm more interested in the more amusing aspects of the day's news. Did you see this? BBC Scotland. Scots told to prepare for a digital Christmas. Yes, the idea of a normal Christmas is a fiction, apparently. And Scots, sweaty socks, should prepare for digital celebrations, according to Jason Leitch. Leitch. Who cares? Tomato. Leitch is the National Clinical Director in Scotland, and he said, forget about Christmas. He said there was absolutely no question of a normal Christmas being allowed. Imagine. I'm not going to swear. I'm not going to lose my temper. I'm not going to rant. I did it all in pre-production. Jumped around the studio by myself in my hermetically sealed studio, soundproofed, screaming at the top of my voice. You have these guys telling you, no way a normal Christmas can be allowed. Yeah, because of the virus. The cases are going up and all the rest of it. So Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, is given these daily briefings. There's no end to them. I don't know what to make of it. It's every single day of the week. Cranky stands there, Jimmy Cranky, telling us what, well, not us, because I don't live in Scotland, telling her compatriots what they need to do every day to stop the virus. Right. So this afternoon, anyway, she was obviously asked about James Leitch and his statement that we couldn't be allowed to have a normal Christmas. What did Cranky say about it?
Look, this is really tough stuff, and I've seen Jason Leitch's comments this morning.
This is really tough stuff.
Morning, and I've seen the totality of his comments, and what he's trying to do is be frank with people about the reality we live in, and not prematurely rule things out, but equally not try to give people false assurance. And that's the really difficult balance we're trying to strike right now. I want us to be able to celebrate Christmas as normally as it is possible to do within the context of a global pandemic. And my message...
Within the context of a global pandemic. We got to change the Christmas cards then, don't we? Happy global pandemic Christmas. Merry global pandemic Christmas, maybe.
To people is that the more we all stick with these really difficult restrictions right now, the more chance there will be of us doing that. And some of the really tough additional things that government is deciding right now, restrictions on hospitality, for example, and any other restrictions we feel necessary to put in place, will also be in part about trying to deal decisively with an upsurge in the virus now so that we give ourselves the best chance of greater normality at Christmas.
All these restrictions that you're finding difficult now and the ones that we might be about to put into place, they're necessary. And if we follow the rules, we just might, children, be able to have a reasonably normal Christmas, eh?
Christmas. And that's part of the objective that we're all working to right now. But Christmas this year, probably for no country anywhere, is going to be absolutely normal without any restrictions. And, you know, I could do what politicians probably do in normal times. I could stand here and try to tell you otherwise and think, well, I'll let people down nearer the time. That's not the right approach right now. So we are unlikely to be able to celebrate Christmas with no limits on the people in our houses and no limits to what we do.
Right. Important you got that. Right. Important you got that.
Otherwise, and think, well, I'll let people down nearer the time. That's not the right approach right now. So we are unlikely to be able to celebrate Christmas with no limits on the people in our houses and no limits to what we do. But the more we get this virus under control right now, the greater normality, the greater chance of having some ability to interact with our loved ones we will have.
Yeah. There are ironies to be found everywhere. A woman who looks like a mentally challenged Oompa Loompa telling you that Christmas is effectively cancelled. A mentally challenged, disabled Oompa Loompa on a daily basis standing at a lectern telling you you might be able to have and you probably won't be able to have and we don't think you'll be able to have as many people in your house at Christmas. This is just, it's laughable this, isn't it? And then the Oompa Loompa or Scotland's First Minister spoke directly to Scotland's children. How do you top this? It's no wonder stand-up comedians have disappeared off the face of the earth. You can't top this shit.
And firstly, on Santa.
On Santa.
I'm pretty sure if there are any kids watching, I'm not sure. I know Santa, it will not be prevented from delivering your presents on Christmas Eve. Santa is a key worker.
Santa's a key worker!
And he's got lots of magic powers that make him safe to do that. So if he's having...
He's got lots of magic powers to make him safe to do that. This isn't a joke. There's no irony. She's not trying to make the assembled press, well, the assembled via television screens, digitally remote, zoomed in press. She's not trying to make them laugh. She's serious. She's serious. Listen, from the top.
And firstly, on Santa, I'm pretty sure if there are any kids watching, I'm not sure. I know Santa, it will not be prevented from delivering your presents on Christmas Eve.
What fucking makes Santa so special?
Santa is a key worker and he's got lots of magic powers that make him safe to do that. So if he's having to do grotto appearances by Zoom, that's to keep you safe. It's not that Santa's at any risk. Santa will be delivering presents across the world as normal.
If Santa is doing Zoom grottos on Zoom, it's not because Santa needs to be protected. He's fine, he's got magic powers. It's so that he doesn't give you coronavirus. Jimmy Cranky. Christmas is cancelled in Scotland. Wow. And there's been a game of one-upmanship going on between Jimmy Cranky and Bojo the Clown since this started. You know, you've seen this. Every time Jimmy Cranky does something, Bojo's government copies it. Effectively just copies it. Sturgeon introduces measures. Boris Johnson's government copies those measures. And so it was the case today. Here's an irate Boris Johnson, in a bit of a foul temper, instructing Health Secretary Matt Hancock to follow Sturgeon's lead again.
Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
Yeah, call off Christmas. And I think he was talking about Marcus Rashford's request for free school meals in the holidays for poor children when he said this. Did you catch that?
Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans.
Cancel even the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. I think that was reference to Marcus Rashford's request that in the half term and at Christmas we keep giving school meals to poor children. Yeah. Mad stuff, this. It's 13 and a half minutes past the hour. So the whole story is falling apart, isn't it? We know this. 99.98% of people who get COVID survive it. Even if they're unwell, they don't die. Even if they go to hospital, 99.98% don't die. It is a mortality rate of less than 0.05%. It's a nonsense, really. But Matt Hancock, the man who makes Walter Mitty look like a fucking grounded realist, keeps calling it lethal. How does he get away with it? I don't know. Here he is in the Commons today.
Our response to this lethal virus has been one of the greatest collective endeavours that this nation has seen. And thanks to those efforts, we are better prepared this time round. As a nation, we built the Nightingale Hospitals in just 9 days. As a nation, we came together as one to protect the NHS, and it wasn't overwhelmed, and now the NHS is better yet prepared still. As a nation, we built the biggest testing capability of all our peers, and we've made huge and historic advances in vaccines and treatments. We understand this virus infinitely more than at the start of this pandemic, but we are not there yet, not when the virus is spreading at pace. So we must, each of us, look at what we can do and the role we can play, and what actions we can take, because we've seen throughout this pandemic, we're at our best when we come together, and we know that with science on our side, ultimately, we will prevail.
We'll prevail, said Matt Hancock. But nobody occupied any of those Nightingale hospitals. The NHS wasn't overrun, and it wouldn't have been overrun, even if you'd allowed people go for their cancer treatments and their treatments for everything else. It's one massive lie after another. It isn't lethal, it isn't a disease, but nobody is holding him to account. The government has decided to ramp up the fear-mongering around this so-called long COVID, right? Long COVID?
Matt Hancock's long COVID.
Long COVID, everywhere yesterday, everywhere today, big time, long COVID. And long COVID has been introduced into the lexicon, right? It's been introduced into our consciousness, into our conscious thoughts, because the rest of the story is falling apart. People are not sick. People are not dying. Hospitals are not overflowing. It's a massive lie. So we've got to introduce the concept of some spooky, weird, long COVID disease where people who had the virus go on to suffer debilitating illnesses for months afterwards. Nonsense. He gets into it here today, does Matt Hancock. Listen to this. He said, yes, the virus predominantly affects the very old and the otherwise unhealthy, but what? But what? Have a listen to this. Pay very careful attention to the question he's asked at the tail end of this.
But the impact is not confined to these groups. The virus can affect anyone of any age and any background, and we've already seen worrying numbers of young, fit, healthy people suffering debilitating symptoms months after contracting COVID. Yesterday, a study by King's College London showed that 1 in 20 people with coronavirus are likely to have virus symptoms like fatigue, breathlessness, muscle pain, and neurological problems for 8 weeks or more. Yesterday, I visited the cutting-edge long COVID clinic at University College London Hospital. I've met people in their 20s and 30s, unable to work, sapped of all their energy, living with the long-term effects of a virus that has completely changed their lives. So to anyone of any age, catching COVID can be very grave indeed. Long COVID underpins again our strategy of suppressing the virus until a vaccine arrives. Yes, of course.
I'm very grateful to my right honourable friend. When he came to the Health Select Committee a few weeks ago, he talked about long COVID and the fact that clinics were being set up to deal with long COVID. Could you give us the House an update on where that's got to?
Yes, sir.
These clinics are being set up. The London clinic is open, but we need to see these clinics right across the country. And the NHS has a programme now of rolling out clinics to be able to support people, and of course communicating to GPs, because primary care is often where people arrive with long COVID, because there appears to be no correlation between the seriousness of your initial illness and how long you can have these debilitating consequences. In some cases, people have no symptoms of the coronavirus initially, but then can find that they have months and months of fatigue and a brain fog and muscle pain, and they didn't know where it came from until they're diagnosed with long COVID. It is a very serious complication, of course.
Mm. You got that bit in the middle of that, didn't you?
It's the overall strategy of suppressing the virus until we can get a vaccine.
Until we can get a vaccine. So some of the backbenchers carried on interrupting Hancock, asking him to give way, which he did, so that he could be questioned by them about the meat on the bones of this long COVID story. And this is good. These backbenchers are doing what the media should be doing, but they aren't doing. Have a listen.
Could you tell us what percentage, say, of people from up to 25 actually suffer from this condition?
Now, what Hancock starts doing from here on in is stuttering, rolling his eyes up into the back of his head and making it up as he goes along.
Yes, we have two points of evidence. The one is the evidence from King's College London that shows that around 1 in 20 people with coronavirus are likely to have these long-term symptoms. The other is the other evidence actually implies that in the under 50-year-old adults, it's more like 1 in 10. So there does seem to be some correlation which implies that it is more of a problem amongst younger people. But understanding this is long COVID is still in early stages, and an awful lot of more research is needed. Yes.
So why don't you shut your fucking mouth then? Why make proclamations like 1 in 10 people under 50 who had COVID go on to develop long COVID? That's a nonsense. That is an utter nonsense. There's been no studies, no proper clinical studies done as to what people might endure or how they might recover from this alleged coronavirus. It's a lie, a monstrous lie. You can't on the one hand say, oh yeah, people under 50 who had the virus, 1 in 10 of those go on to get long COVID, and then in the same breath say that, well, this is really very early, we really don't know what's going on with this. It is a lie. And he knows it's a lie, Hancock. He knows it as he is saying it. You can tell by the way he's delivering it.
Yes.
Well, just to press that, but it's not so much the question of what percentage of those who contract the disease, but what percentage of the overall cohort is actually roughly actually affected by this.
And again, listen to Hancock.
Well, it's very difficult to know. We estimate that around 8% of the population have had COVID, and we estimate that around 1 in 20 people who've had it have symptoms for longer than 8 weeks. Of course, the fewer people get COVID, the fewer people who will get long COVID, and therefore it reinforces the overall strategy of suppressing the virus until we can get a vaccine.
And again,
the overall strategy of suppressing the virus until we can get a vaccine.
Twice he said that, and that's what it's all about. Long COVID is the get out of jail free card. As the country is increasingly waking up to the fact that this is one of the most monstrous, grotesque lies ever foisted upon the public in this country or any country, they've had to grasp at straws. As the newspapers begin to do their jobs and decimate the lies about case rises in Manchester and hospitalizations going up in Manchester, which is totally untrue. The opposite is true, while the enforced tier 3 lockdown measures here. The papers are wising up to it and asking questions. Shit, well, long COVID will do. Let's just start talking about long COVID, a sinister disease that could keep people living in a state of, I don't know, constant fatigue and feeling unwell and headaches and fevers for months. Just make it up, all on the hoof, all of it. And it's left to a few backbenchers in Westminster to dig down into this and ask this guy for some details. And when they do, he has none. It is garbage. 23 minutes past the hour. I wanted to go very briefly to the... Boris Johnson gave a briefing at Downing Street this afternoon. I think it was just after 4 o'clock. He was flanked, was Johnson, by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, but also by Patrick Vallance, the government's chief scientific advisor and another pathological lawyer. Here's Vallance talking about the vaccine. Right, the vaccine, the vaccine, the vaccine. That's been the approach this week, long COVID and the vaccine. Here's Vallance.
On vaccines, I think, you know, things are progressing well. There are vaccines that produce an immune response.
I don't know what happened there. Should we try that again, shall we? It's not even a Monday. Let's try it again. Let's hear Vallance on the vaccine. It just jumped off my screen there.
On vaccines, I think, you know, things are progressing well. There are vaccines that produce an immune response. They're in phase three clinical trials. We should be seeing some data readouts over the course of this year. But I remain of the view that the possibility of sort of wider spread use of vaccines isn't going to be until spring or so next year, by the time we get enough doses and enough understanding of the outputs to use them. Now, we may get a few doses this side of Christmas. Maybe something could happen. But I think we should more realistically be looking at spring. And, of course, there are no guarantees until the studies have read out. So we need to be cautious and carry on. But there is a good progress in terms of the vaccine.
Remember, of those who get coronavirus 19, whatever it is, and I don't know what it is, I'm not convinced. I remain to be convinced that coronavirus itself is real. Right? I don't know. I'm working on the principle, I'm working on the premise that there was a virus. You know, a lot of people I know came down with a pretty rotten virus back in January of this year, including myself. I'm open-minded. But 99.98% of people who get COVID survive it. That's a staggering thing. It hardly touches anybody. It virtually ignores young people. The average age of somebody dying with it now, because with it means that the person was sick anyway, the average age is 82. 82. And they're talking about keeping people living in this state of bewilderment, in this state of fear and worry as things collapse around them, society collapses, the economy collapses, their futures disappear. Keep going. Do what we tell you until the spring and the vaccine will arrive. That's the cavalry. It's 26 minutes past the hour. Let's have a tune. John Waters, live Irish journalist in hour two. Before that, I'll be joined by Stephen Lendeman, live from Chicago, a great friend of mine and a brilliant journalist. Alrighty, welcome to your Richie Allen Radio Show, Thursday, October 22nd. Yeah, Steve Harley there on the Richie Allen Radio Show. 29 and a half minutes past 5 o'clock it is. Drive time here in Salford in the northwest of the UK. I love my guest this hour. He's a terrific journalist and a great broadcaster. Love that he shares his time with us. You can read him at his website, stephenlendman.org. What a time to be speaking with him. Live from the Windy City, the one and only Stephen Lendman. Stephen, welcome back. It's been too long. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Richie, indeed. I'm very delighted to be on. You're a terrific host, and I love coming on with you. Well, and we always discuss important issues.
We certainly do. Thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. I suppose the best place to start is you're 12 days out from the election, the presidential election. I know later tonight, UK time, Donald Trump and Joe Biden will debate for the final time. But the story about the United States getting the most coverage today, comments made by the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, and I know you've covered this on StephenLendman.org, he alleges that there is an abundance of evidence that both Russia and Iran have been trying to meddle in your presidential election. Is he talking through his hat, or is there any substance to those claims?
Well, I can't use the words that I would most like to use, or only mumble them under my breath privately. or off the air to some friends. I mean, we see this stuff happening time and again, Richie. There have been so many accusations by the U.S. and the West against Russia, Iran, China, Venezuela, all country, two common denominators. They're all countries that are independent of U.S. control. That's number one. And when the accusations are made, there never is any credible evidence accompanying them. Now, if you took these cases into a court of law, a legitimate tribunal, the judge would throw them out. The case wouldn't last, or maybe a few minutes, a very short period of time, the case would throw them out. There simply is no evidence backing the claim. I called it the U.S. claim about Russian-U.S. election meddling. The big lie that refuses to die. Well, Russia did not meddle in the 2016 U.S. election. There's no evidence that it will meddle in the election a week from Tuesday. This is a lot of baloney. Of course, Iran hasn't done it.
The thing about these accusations, you make a good point there about the evidence. When pressed, and I don't think television journalists are in the habit of pressing these men, but on occasion, when somebody does ask a question, their stock answer is, we can't reveal information. It might compromise the ongoing investigation. So it's basically a case of, we're the spooks. If we tell you that Iran and Russia is meddling, you better believe us. That's how it works, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it works. In 2016, there was a U.S. intelligence community report, and they said they couldn't reveal the evidence because it was classified.
Classified, yeah.
I mean, that's malarkey, Richie, as we know. I mean, it's code language for saying, we don't have any, but we don't want to tell you that.
That's what it means. And I suppose it's a good time to mention Hillary Clinton, the DNC, and Seth Rich. Yeah, something I've covered extensively. I've had Bill Binney on this program in the past talking about it. Any servers being hacked and, spied on and snooped on, it was probably done by people working on behalf of Hillary Clinton, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that anything involving the Dem Party. And I've said this a number of times. I never call them Democrats, Richie, because there's nothing democratic about them. So I call them Dems instead. Sometimes I call them undemocratic Dems, which is what they are. The U.S. is not a democracy. Other Western countries are not democracy. Hillary Clinton, I thought of her as the worst Secretary of State in U.S. history until she was surpassed by the current incumbent, Pompeo, that even the Washington Post a number of weeks ago just ripped him up one side and down the other, calling him the worst U.S. Secretary of State in the country's history. I mean, he's a thug. He's not a diplomat with presidential ambitions, which makes him very dangerous. And he infamously said when he was CIA director, we lied, we cheated, we stole.
Yeah.
Amazing he would say that, Richie.
He did. He was at the University of Texas. I've actually got the audio here. I could dig it out and play it. You're right, he was addressing a university crowd, and he thought it was funny. He was yucking it up, chuckling, as he was saying, yeah, we take an oath to say that we won't lie, cheat, and steal. The very first thing we do when we get in the gig, when we get the job, is we lie, cheat, and steal. Can I just put it to you? I share many of your sentiments about Iran and Russia. I don't see Iran and Russia as any existential threat to world peace. I don't believe the stories that come out of the US and out of Israel and out of the UK about Iran. I think Iran should be left alone. But are we a bit naive to imagine or to assume that Iran wouldn't have a favoured candidate? And if Iran, as an independent sovereign state, if it had a favoured candidate in the election, why wouldn't it, mess around with social media and put some propaganda out there? I wouldn't blame Iran for doing it, Stephen. So why are we so quick to rule that out?
Well, I certainly agree with you, Richie. I quoted an Iranian official in my article today saying that Iran does not have a favorite candidate. It really makes no difference to Iran which one wins. Well, I think Iran would prefer Biden over Trump by a small margin. By no means, if Biden wins, will he jump right back into the JCPOA nuclear deal. What he wants is a renegotiated agreement, which Iran does not want to do. He wants more obligations put on Iran, not related to a nuclear program, which of course Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. I mean, everybody in Washington knows that. It was a while back, Richie, that I said annually the U.S. intelligence community puts out a report on world threats to the U.S. Well, there really aren't any. But when they come to Iran, they make a comment like, there is no information to suggest that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And then there's usually a line that's added to the effect that, well, we don't know. We don't know that it doesn't have one. Maybe they do have one. We just don't have any evidence to show they have one. Well, and if Iran had a nuclear weapons program, you can bet you the CIA would know about it.
They would know.
There is none. And Iran threatens nobody. Iran is at war with nobody now. China is at war with nobody. Russia is at war with nobody. Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Syria. Syria is defending itself against U.S. aggression using ISIS and other terrorists as proxy fighters. But these countries threaten nobody. They're not at war with anybody. But if attacked, they'll defend themselves. Iran hasn't attacked another country in centuries.
Yeah.
So if it was Persia before around 1933 and 1934.
We've got Stephen Lendman live on the programme. If you haven't bookmarked stephenlendman.org, you're really missing a trick. He's a great, great writer. And he's the most objective journalist I know writing in the independent media today. He does occasionally appear on Press TV, but his comments and his opinions are his own and he's totally independent. Love having you on, Stephen. I want to talk a little bit about Trump, if you don't mind. Should we read anything into the claims? I find so much of this so very funny because I've learned a lot from people like you over the years that it doesn't really matter whether it's Tweedledum or Tweedledee in the White House. I know that. But still, I laugh at some of the stories. They're so soap opera-like in the way they're reported. Trump allegedly has business in China and he has a bank account there. Is this just nonsense or is it something that's worth looking into? What do you think?
Well, of course, the Trump organization has interests overseas. I have no idea where they are. I think at one time he went to Russia to see if he could put together a deal. I don't think he has any hotels or any real estate development projects in Russia. I have no idea what the company may have in China. But if he or the company do have that. That's what business enterprises do. I mean, U.S. companies have business interests in many, many countries around the world, especially China. China probably more than any other country besides internally in the U.S.
Tell us about every time you come on, somebody rings. This is how famous the Richie Allen Show is. Whenever you're on the show, somebody hears and says, Lendman, yeah. Lendman is on the Richie Allen Show. So what about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son? A lot of my listeners, it pains me to admit this, a lot of my listeners, they've learned nothing from us in the years we've been speaking. Many of them are big supporters of President Donald Trump. I beat them with sticks, Stephen. I scream at them, but they don't listen. They love Trump. And they tell me that this Hunter Biden email scandal is a big story and it could be the undoing of Biden if there's enough time for Trump to make, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's going to come up tonight in the debate. Do you want to give my listeners a brief overview of what the Hunter Biden scandal is all about?
Well, he's really a pathetic figure, Richie. It's really a shame. If he weren't Biden's son, I would feel very sorry for him. He just messed up his life, got mixed up with cocaine, maybe other drugs. He's been in rehab, I believe, a number of times, mixed up with underage girls, having sex with underage girls, other things that are really despicable. But I think there must be some kind of a mental problem with him, and Daddy Biden wants it covered up, and I don't think Hunter has any particular expertise for the deals he's gotten into, the companies that he's been associated with, and so on. I think it's all related to the influence of his dad. That any country would be very happy to give Hunter hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to please his dad for whatever benefits these companies could get from the U.S. because of Biden's influence when he was a U.S. senator and especially as vice president, and now as was a presidential candidate. There was a story just today or the other day that the deals that that Hunter Biden put together in China, Daddy Biden got a piece of that. And how much was involved, I don't know, but I suspect it could be at least hundreds of thousands of dollars and maybe millions of dollars.
It's alleged, and, sorry to interrupt you, Stephen, it's alleged that Joe Biden got a 10% cut. That's the allegation. Now, if there's any truth in that, it's bad news for Joe Biden, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think Trump will make a big deal out of this. There'll be another so-called debate tonight that are not debates. You can call it whatever you want. I call them prescriptive theater. Yeah. They have nothing to do with debates. Long ago, as a young student, Richie, a teenager, I participated in a debate in junior high school. Well, the debate I participated in was nothing like the theatrics that goes on during so-called presidential debates. I don't remember the topic, but I do remember it was very, very civil between me and one other person. I mean, we were classmates. So we discussed an issue and expressed our opinion, and that was fine. I remember being a little bit nervous at the time. I'd never done anything like that before, but I felt nervous the first time. I've done a lot of things. And it's the first time I ever had an interview after I began writing in 2005, Richie. It was in 2006. I had an interview on a St. Louis radio station, and for the first one ever. And I was uneasy about it. I didn't want to make a fool of myself. And for about a minute, I was nervous when the interview began. And then I settled down. And I still remember at the end of the interview, I said to the host, who was a very friendly woman, I think we went the better part of an hour. She spent about 15 minutes herself, and we went about three quarters of an hour. At the end of the time, I said, "You want to do another hour?"
You took to it like a hand to a glove, no doubt. Stephen Lenman is our guest. And we hear that tonight there's a mute button so that when candidates go over their allotted 2 minutes, or if they start to shout, if they start to try and encroach on the other person's 2 minutes, the host can silence them. Is that right, Stephen?
Yeah, that's the rules. Now, of course, Trump could do whatever he wants. And even if the mic is turned off for the TV audience, if I don't know, there may be a studio audience as well. But if the mic is turned off, Biden is, 15 feet away from him or so. Yeah. I mean, Trump could do whatever he wants and interrupt Biden speaking. So I don't think that rule will have any impact at all. What bothers me is that the moderators are very anti-Trump. That certainly was the case with Chris Wallace. I heard the name of the woman, I think a woman moderating tonight. I heard the name, but I have no idea who she is or who she's with. She's probably anti-Trump. I mean, the books are cooked against Trump to lose and for Biden to win. But I'll tell you something, Richie, it will not surprise me at all if Biden loses and Trump wins.
And we're talking, of course, about a week on Tuesday. So you're calling it for Trump. You think he's got... He whatever the polls are saying, I know the polls are saying at the moment that he's behind and he's struggling, but you think there's enough time for that to change between now and Tuesday week?
Well, I think the polls are not accurate. I did survey work, my first job after getting an MBA, and I understand the importance of keeping bias out of questions asked and having a truly random sample of a universe. But what I've heard about the polls, I don't know that all of them, but a good many of them, I think, is they're oversampling registered Dem voters and undersampling GOP registered voters. Well, that will bring a skewed bias result every time if you do that. I think it was a Wall Street Journal, Washington Post poll that gave Biden a 14-point lead. And on the same day, another poll that was conducted on the same 2 days, gave Biden about a 3-point lead.
Right.
Well, you can see the difference of that.
That's massive, massive difference. And of course, if you're Biden, you're going to be nervous about any poll that shows you're in the lead, because your big concern is that some voters won't turn up on November 3rd because they'll think, oh, my guy's got it in the bag. You know yourself, candidates worry about these alleged big leads. Just a couple of quick opinions on Trump. Again, for my listeners who seem to like this guy, I don't know why, but anyway, they do. I don't like any of them. So they tolerate me because I don't, like yourself, I don't have any time for any of them. So they say to me, Richie, he has done well for the economy. The economy has, by all measures, measuring it whichever way you like, He's done a lot better with jobs and with prosperity than his predecessors, Obama, Bush Jr. and so on. Is there any truth to that? I know you'll give an honest answer.
Well, until this year, there was some truth to it, but that certainly is not the case this year, Richie. Real unemployment in the U.S., based on the way the number was calculated pre-1990, after which they rigged the model to come up with phony numbers. I just put this in an article I'll post tomorrow. Real inflation in the U.S. is over 7.5%. The official number is 1.4%. It's a phony number. Real unemployment in the U.S. is 26.9%. During the Great Depression, 1930s, unemployment peaked at 25%. So unemployment now is higher than it was during the Great Depression. But 31 consecutive weeks, Richie, over a million Americans filed for unemployment benefits. There's never been anything remotely like this in U.S. history. The highest number before in a single week was a little under 700,000. I think 695, something like that. But the latest number, I believe it's over a million. I'll get the exact number tomorrow. They divide it in two sections: unemployment insurance and pandemic unemployment insurance. And the numbers published by the U.S. media are only the former, and they leave the latter out. So the former was something like 757,000 or 787,000 today, published today. But I think there's at least a few hundred thousand of pandemic, PUA it's called, pandemic unemployment assistance, PUA. I think it's over a few hundred thousand. So that'll get up to maybe 1.2 million. 31 consecutive weeks, Richie, since March.
Now, Trump would say, Stephen, Trump would say, if he was here, not that he ever would be, but if he was here, he would say, well, the virus is not my fault, number one, he would say. And number two, he would say, I've told places to open up. I've told places to open their businesses. I've told Democratic governors and Democratic mayors to, you know, not to tell businesses to close down, to get people back to work. That's what he would say.
Well, what I would say is this. COVID-19 is not a virus. It's a disease. SARS-CoV-2 is the virus that produces COVID disease. That's number one. It was not manufactured in China unless the U.S. had a separate section of the Wuhan lab and did its dirty work there. But I call it the made in the USA COVID disease. And a made in the USA economic collapse since March this year, probably getting worse next year. I've quoted economists who I respect who say what's going on right now is a depression that will be protracted. It may last throughout the 2020s. And some are saying things will never go back to the way they were before the beginning of this year. Well, I don't know if it's true or not. I may not live enough, long enough to see whether it goes through the 2020s, but I do believe I've never seen anything like what's going on now. I think it will be protracted. I've said it myself in articles. And Americans, ordinary Americans, are suffering terribly. There's severe food insecurity. Homelessness is growing. People don't have jobs. People who do have jobs, employers have cut wages. They've cut benefits. Millions of Americans have no health insurance. It's a dismal situation. You would think, based on what's happened from March through now, that Trump would be a loser for sure. But he may be a winner.
He might be a winner. And again, just to reiterate, the unemployment figures for 31 weeks in a row, his supporters and his own administration will say, we were doing okay. We didn't bring this virus or whatever disease, as you call it, on top of us. They would say that. I'm with you. Whatever this is, I believe it was manufactured. I have no proof of that, but I believe it was. And I believe that it was brought about and introduced for very sinister reasons, for reasons that most people can't even fathom. I really do believe that, to change civilization, to change humanity. And of course, if I'm right and if you're right, of course, Donald Trump wouldn't have anything to do with that. Neither would Joe Biden or Boris Johnson or Emmanuel Macron. These guys are just puppets, aren't they? They're not calling the shots, really.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Richie. Yeah, these people are front people for the power system, and dark forces behind the scenes do their dirty work, no matter who sits in the White House or key positions of Congress. And I truly believe that Trump absolutely has no information on who is behind this, how it all got started, everything behind it. So he only knows what the people around him tell him.
Yeah.
He's a businessman. He's not a politician. He got thrust into the highest office in the world, you can say, the presidency of the U.S., commander-in-chief of the U.S. military. And he's a guy who knows nothing about this stuff. But he doesn't have to know anything about this. He only has to be a front man. But the powers behind the scenes, military, economic, political, and so on, they're the ones that are manipulating the system and doing what they want to do. And the other big deal about what's going on is it's been a massive, unprecedented wealth transfer from ordinary people to super rich people.
Yeah.
And an article I'll put out tomorrow that the U.S. billionaires, over 600 U.S. billionaires, have gained, their super wealth has grown by over $900 billion this year at a time of dismal conditions for ordinary Americans.
You don't have to be Lieutenant Columbo, do you, Stephen, to figure out what's going on? Because it's the same time and time again. Stephen Lenman, we've got Stephen for another 7 or 8 minutes till the top of the hour. I love the man. He's an octogenarian, is Stephen. It's on the internet, so there's no hiding it. He's 86 years old. I hate when people say things like 86 years young. It's very patronising, isn't it? You're ancient, Stephen. You're ancient. But you're still here, and you're still writing some absolutely fantastic articles on your website. The reason why I bring up your age, my friend, is it something that concerns you? I mean, you look, you know, when I see you doing your thing for Press TV and elsewhere, you look very, very healthy. Your voice, your strength of character, your sound, you sound fantastic. You sound vibrant. But we are told that whatever COVID is, that, you know, people in their 70s and 80s, they should be a bit concerned about it. Do you worry about it? Do you take any precautions over there?
Well, the main precaution I take, Richie, is I have a healthy lifestyle. I don't eat junk food. I eat healthy food. I exercise every day. I try very hard to take care of myself. Anybody who gets to my age has issues, so I have them like everybody else, but they're pretty stable. I saw one of my favorite doctors yesterday, had a lovely, lovely conversation with her. I send her an article every now and then so she knows what I do. I usually discuss issues a little bit with most of my doctors. They all know what I do. But you get to my age, I don't have the energy I had years ago, but I can still put in long hours every day. I couldn't do hard labor.
For a day. No heavy lifting, but you can sit behind the computer and push out the articles. It's speaking of the age, the other reason I mentioned your age, and I've never been a patronizing person. I never have been. But one of the things that's happened in the last 6, 8, 9 months is there's been, and I felt this has been going on for a few years anyway, there's been a war on the elderly and on senior people. And it's been a kind of a quiet war. You know, older people have been marginalised. They've been forgotten. And I think that's a deliberate agenda. Because if you go back through civilisation, the senior people were always the leaders of any tribe or of any community. And when people needed to know anything, or if they needed a dispute, solved or resolved, there was always the senior man. I love people like you, Stephen, because you've lived for years. You've lived, you've loved, you've experienced, you've travelled, you've seen things. I mean, you're better than any library. But I've seen in recent years a real attack on the integrity of senior people. Have you felt that yourself?
Yeah, that really is true. The famous U.S. comedian who passed away, I forget how many years ago, Jerry Lewis, there was a Martin and Lewis combo and then Jerry Lewis on his own, but he made a very serious comment at one point saying, we throw out old people and garbage.
Yeah.
A very prescient comment that he made. That's exactly right. And I remember writing about Mickey Rooney, the famous U.S. actor. He got screwed by his caregivers when he was in his 90s. He testified before Congress, practically begging people of Congress to do something to help the elderly in the U.S., where a famous figure like Mickey Rooney could get ripped off and harmed greatly by people around him. There were no laws protecting the elderly in the U.S. There were laws, I guess, protecting everybody. everybody, sort of, but nothing specifically for the elderly. And he testified before Congress, and I wrote an article about it. It was a number of years ago. I could dig it out and find it. But those two comments by Jerry Lewis and Mickey Rooney, and I'm sure others feel the same thing. Old people in America are people that the powers that be, the dark forces, would prefer to get rid of, yeah, and not have to pay Social Security and Medicare to people like me. What Henry Kissinger called useless eaters.
He did.
That's his definition.
He did, didn't he? And it's the social contract that they fool everybody with. They tell us all. I mean, I remember going to high school, and you're told in... We studied everything in high school. We did bookkeeping. We did everything. Commerce and all of that. Oh, work hard now and pay your taxes and pay your national insurance and you'll be very comfortable. You'll be looked after in your old age. But that's one of the biggest lies of all time, Stephen, isn't it? It's just a massive lie, because once you get to old age, they find a million excuses not to take care of you and throw you to the curb, as you said.
Well, I think everyone is lucky, Richie, if when we get to our end time, we could just collapse, which happened. My dad died much too young at age 65. My mother remarried a few years later. Her second husband, a very lovely man, when his end time came, he collapsed on the living room floor and he was gone. That's the way to go, Richie.
That's the way to go.
I can't think of a better way to go than that.
Fantastic. Lovely way to leave it today. Please do me a favour. Come back before... It's been about 4 months since you were on, which is too long. But do come back before Christmas so we can have a catch-up before the end of the year. I'd love that. Stephen's website is stephenlendman.org. And my word means something. I don't promote or recommend very much. Stephen is a fantastic writer of great experience. And you can catch him on a number of different independent news radio shows and television shows as well as Press TV. Look after yourself, mate. Great to hear you in great voice. Enjoy the debate later on. It should be high comedy. And I look forward to you coming back on before Christmas.
Richie, I love being on with you because you're such a terrific host. I'll flatter you a little bit. And I love coming on anytime you've got a spot on your schedule open to get me on. My joy to come on with you.
You're a gent. Thanks very much, Stephen. We'll make it happen more often. The lovely Stephen Lendman, live from Chicago, stephenlendman.org. Yeah, it's going to be interesting later on, isn't it? Hunter Biden. It's going to be Hunter Biden. And deals and business deals and 10% for daddy and all of this sort of stuff. I've not watched a US presidential election debate since Jesus. I never watched any of Obama's with John McCain. I might have watched Bush and Kerry, and after that I gave up. Right, Buffalo Springfield on the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford here in Lancashire in Greater Manchester. My name is Richie Allen. How you doing? Sound, everybody look what's going,
we better stop. Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
The Richie Allen Show is live and interactive. All episodes are archived on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. For more details, go to richieallen.co.uk.
Yes, richieallen.co.uk. Welcome back. It's coming up for 3 minutes past six. John Waters is standing by. He said hello. That's always good. It's a good sign, that. It's a good sign. Let me give a shout out to triggerwarning.tv, Hayden Hewitt, and Stephen Englander, and Graham Booth. There's a big business live event happening tonight, youtube.com/triggerwarningTV. Check it out. You might have a business, you might have a small business, a medium-sized business, and you might have questions. You might be wondering about the Tier 3 lockdown level here in Manchester. You might be somewhere else in the country. They're doing a show tonight, a trigger warning. Look for Hayden Hewitt on Twitter to find the links to it. I've made a complete bags now of telling you what's happening. Well, I've not done too bad. So triggerwarning.tv, youtube.com/triggerwarning. Do check it out. Really good guys. I have a lot of time for them. Lots of tweets as well came in there when I was speaking with Stephen. Thank you for them. Thank you. I made the point that Trump couldn't take the hit personally for the redundancies and for the joblessness owing to this scamdemic, whatever it is, plandemic, whatever. I made the point. I'm a good presenter. I challenge my guests. All right. Trump's still in Egypt. But you believe what you want to believe. They're all puppets, every one of them. Two sides of the same coin. Let's get John on the programme then. And I'm looking forward to this. It's been quite a while since he was on the show. John Waters is a brilliant Irish journalist and writer of terrific books. I'll put links out to where you can find these books. Give Us Back the Bad Roads, an amazing read, which I think it's actually Jean Anne sent me that, a wonderful book, Give Us Back the Bad Roads. Great journalist. Grew up watching him and listening to him on television and radio. Just before we say hello to him, Will Goodbody is the business editor of RTE.ie. And late this afternoon, he's been writing about on the RTE website about how shop owners are being appealed to abide by the rules because reports are coming out of some parts of Ireland, some parts of Dublin, that some non-essential retailers are justifying opening by stocking small amounts of items classed as essential. You see, Ireland is under level 5 lockdown restrictions now, which is a national lockdown, which is supposed to last for 6 weeks until December 1st. It's crippling the economy. It's destroying businesses. It's destroying lives. I could be here all day long. Let's just welcome back the writer, the journalist and the broadcaster, John Waters. John, thanks for coming back on, mate. Great to have you back. How are you?
Hi, Richard. How are you doing? Can you hear me well, yeah?
You sound brilliant. You sound like you're in the same room as me, such is the technology. How depressing is this, John?
It's hard to describe it, Richie. It's just literally grinding people down. And to be clear now, I'm convinced, I've gone a long journey on this, I'm convinced that is the purpose of it. It is literally to grind the human spirit into the dust. It has nothing to do with health. Let us get that out of the way at the very beginning. This is about grinding down the spirit of humanity in Ireland and elsewhere, but I speak in Ireland for my own people. And the terrible, terrible thing about it is that the vast majority of those people cannot see it. They feel it. I mean, people are absolutely at their wit's end. They don't really know what it is. Their superficial symptoms are irritation, you know, anger. You know, that you can hear the statistics about the increase in domestic violence and all this stuff. You know, that's only a superficial indicator of what we're talking about. I can see it. I can feel it from people. There's a sense of almost like they're vibrating with this sense of frustration and fear and rage and incomprehension about this. And they listen to these idiotic politicians, you know, shouting in their jaw doll chamber, if they do, in the parliamentary chambers, pretending to debate this. 50 seconds per person, by the way, is what they were allowed during the debate on the recent introduction of the escalation of the whole thing. 50 seconds per speaker.
Was there any dissent? Was there any politician there who said, this is crazy, we're destroying the country?
There was. There's a guy called Michael McNamara from, I think he's from Limerick or Clare, one of those places. He used to be a Labour Party TD, and then he lost his seat and he came back in the last election, I think, as an independent. And he was the chairman of the COVID committee. But you see, this is remarkable. This is a remarkable syndrome I've noticed. And I noticed it in his speech, which was very good up to a point. And this is how I would describe the point at which it ceased to be good, was when he started warning about the consequences if there was no debate and if that what he was saying was not listened to. And here I'm with him, totally. And then he said, you know, that essentially he was saying it will move to the next phase, which is violence, right? But what he said was that we don't want to debate it outside the house, the gates of this house, by violent groups confronting each other. Now, that's a reference to something which is a kind of become a trope of the official commentary and the media commentary, where they talk about protesters against the lockdown as the far right. You see? And what happens then is that the state, Richie, buses in the filth of the earth from Northern Ireland, mainly from terrorist groups up there, from Antifa, all of these groups, they're bussed in and they're paid a day's wages to disrupt these protests, which they do. And then the media are able to say that there were violent confrontations outside Leinster House between protesters, right? Yeah. And this guy hasn't got the brain power to figure it out, even though the dog passing in the street can see it. Because I'll tell you why, that the anti-mask protests, which they're called unapologetically, unashamedly, by the journalists, with the photographs and the video footage, shows most of the people causing the trouble are wearing masks, except they're not masks in the sense of that we normally use this term now. They're actually face coverings, they're disguises. This is what Antifa looks like.
Let me ask you this, you'd expect me to. You made a claim there that people are getting a day's wages and are being bussed down from the north. Is there any categoric evidence? Is there any unflappable evidence to prove that? Have you got definitive proof of that?
Well, what is definitive proof? We know it. We know this from the proximity of these people. Nobody ever saw them before. Their accents are not our accents. They're not from here. Why are they in Dublin? We know, for example, that back in earlier in the year, at another protest about free speech, there were people from an organisation, I think it's called CORE or something like that.
Yeah.
There's some kind, and they were involved in the killing of a woman in the north last year, a young woman. A shooting who was shot in the course of a demonstration.
A journalist, wasn't it? It was a journalist. Right, yes.
And they were there. It was actually last November. At a protest, which this is a perfect example, actually, Richie. It was people who were protesting against the introduction of hate speech laws, which was being mooted at that time by the then Minister for Justice, Charlie Flanagan. And there was a counter-protest organised by the NGOs who have a deep vested interest in the mass migration issue, including Trócaire, which is run by the Irish Catholic bishops, right?
Yeah.
And all of these Trócaire, all of these NGO members were out, but all these thugs were out as well. And it was established on that occasion that these people were there from the north, very definitively, and not denied. Not denied. Not denied by the Catholic bishops, not denied by Trócaire, not denied by any of the NGOs. So this is going on. There's no question about it. Myself and Jim O'Doherty, 2 weeks ago, wrote a letter to the chair commissioner of Garda Síochána, who mysteriously is from Northern Ireland as well. He too is bussed in, Richie, huh? Along with his two most senior officers. They're bussed in. What is this about, eh? To run our police force. Have we no senior police officers in Ireland who are in the Republic of Ireland who are capable of running our own police force? We wrote him a letter calling him out on a number of things, including the fact that they didn't have any laws any longer to implement the regulations. It is quite clear now that the guards are now, the police are out in the street, are busking it. Because they don't actually have any law. I'll just explain this in a moment.
Yeah.
But I just want to finish the point here, that we also made the point that his repeated assertion about the far right in Ireland has been completely lacking a scintilla of evidence. There is no far right in Ireland.
No.
None. Not one person in Ireland can be called far right. These people who are out protesting are ordinary, decent, hard-working people whose hearts are broken by this scum.
As a trade unionist and somebody who always voted on the left, I'm going to endorse what you said. There's never been any any far right in the country. Listen, you know I've got a lot of sympathy with the claim that that agent provocateurs come in to make ordinary people look bad. I totally agree with that, but I just want to go back.
I saw it with my own eyes, Richie.
But can I just cover my own arse? I don't doubt that for a minute. But on them, on people getting paid to come down, I've got to cover my arse here. There isn't any real proof of that. I understand why you suspect it, but there isn't any definitive proof that I could show my listeners.
Do we have to produce receipts of their wages? Like, how do we say, what is proof?
I know, but in a court of law, a judge would say you do, John. If you're going to say that people are getting paid, you do. But look, I don't want to argue with you about that because I fundamentally agree with you. I just want to make the point. I understand why you're saying these things. I love you for doing what you're doing.
I was in Balbriggan during the election with Jim O'Doherty one night, and there was a meeting which she had organised. She had been barred. Every time she tried to hold a public meeting in a hotel, these thugs got onto the hotel and intimidated them until they cancelled her booking.
Yeah, I remember, right? Yeah.
Well, in the end, she had to hire a disused judo gym, it was. And she advertised a meeting for there. When I arrived, there were about 70 of these masked thugs gathered outside the gate. They came at me menacingly and my wife, you know, threateningly. I walked on. I got into the place. They then, Justin Barrett, the leader of the National Party, was due to speak also. And when he arrived in his car, he made the mistake of trying to get in the gate. They got on top of his car like monkeys. They started banging his windscreen. And I'll tell you now the most important thing, Richie. While all this was happening, there was a bunch of Gardaí standing watching.
Yeah, I remember this.
And in the end, their remedy to the entire situation, do you know what it was? Was it to arrest a member of these masked thugs? No, it wasn't. It was to tell Justin Barrett that if he didn't drive away, they would arrest him for blocking the road.
For blocking the road, yeah.
Now, do you think those men on a bitter, cold January night, that those people are there for the good of their health? We've never seen them before.
I'm not naive, but you know I have to do my job. You're a journalist, I'm a journalist. I'm not naive. I would draw the conclusion you drew. And you're also making a very good point here that's come up on this programme many times. The attempt by the state and its lackey media to reassign people who are nationalists, genuine people who are nationalists and believe in their country, believe in Ireland and believe in an Ireland and an Irish culture, which I have no problem with. Why would I? But to redefine those people as racist and as far right, that disgusts me. It sickens me, to be honest.
Thank you, Richie. And let me tell you something else about this, because it's interesting. Because, you see, there's a very interesting kind of spin being done. Because myself and Gemma were the first people to step out and resist this tyranny, this encroaching tyranny, right, in April. Yeah. Like let me remind people, and I'm just for the record, that there were a series in March. There was a series of moves. The law was brought in on the 20th of March, was voted. And then there had been, the pubs had been closed, I think, from about the 12th of March by a different kind of order, which is open to the Gardaí to do, I believe. And then there was a series of what would be called soft lockdowns of shops and restaurants as March progressed. But it wasn't until the 7th of April that there was a lockdown of the people in their houses, as it were, in their own lives, the citizens. The 2-kilometre rule was brought in, that you couldn't be any more than 2 kilometres from your house. There was people asking you where the guards were asking where you're going. That came in on the basis of a law on the 7th of April. That was Holy Week. I think it was about the Tuesday or the Wednesday of Holy Week. Within 1 week of that, the following 15th, Easter intervened, and Gemma and I were at the Four Courts on the 15th, the Wednesday after Easter. Yeah. We had put together our papers to apply for a judicial review of this legislation. Now, there's an interesting spin here that the media are coming up with, like, oh, that the far right have hijacked the COVID issue. And the implication, and you have the so-called Taoiseach. He's not my Taoiseach. He is not the Taoiseach. He's not even elected. He is part of a cobbled together, illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional quasi-government. He's talking about why are they going around? Why are these protesters carrying the Irish flag? Well, I'll tell him why. Because we are Irish and we are fighting for freedom still. and we are now fighting against him and his ilk, who have taken the place of the occupier in our lives.
I don't understand.
We have fought this issue.
This is
an issue of pure freedom.
Freedom, yeah. I don't understand how a guy like you can... I mean, you're obviously very passionate this evening. I'm not patronising you by saying that. I expect you to be passionate. And, you know, you're a fantastic talker, great speaker. As a journalist, as somebody who did it properly, as somebody who was surrounded by people mostly who did it properly, how you can live with that, with lawyers working for the national press, writing what they know to be lies about people, calling people racist and fascist, yeah, when they know it to be untrue, how they can look themselves in the mirror, I have no idea.
Well, you see, this is interesting, Richie, because they tried to call me this, but they're cagey with me because they know that I will pick them up. But it's very interesting. Recently there, a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, I've lost track of time, as everybody has.
Yeah.
RTE, the national broadcaster, so-called, with quotation marks around the word national, obviously, wrote to me saying they were doing an item. An item means, that translates as hit job, concerning my position on issues to do with nationalism, and so the new nationalism they were calling. So I immediately translated this. I didn't need Google to translate to tell me what they were doing. They were doing a hit job and they were going to call me a fascist. And I wrote back to them and saying, great, that's fine, I won't be participating. But tell you what, I've written about 2,000, at least 2,000 articles in my life. And I've written 10 books. And I've been on countless times, not alone on your channel, on your channels, but on a lot of other ones as well.
National telly.
You're going to be doing a hit job. Want to make sure you have absorbed all of the material that's there, because you will need it to defend anything that you say about me that is not true.
Absolutely right, John. Absolutely right.
So, because this is what they do. That's what they do. You see, like, I've been there. I was in that studio. I was in the RTE. You know, we were down there recently outside. And I said, pointed up to the glass, windows and the tower, the big mast they have outside. And I said, once upon a time, I said, this used to be a truth factory. And I used to go in there myself, and I would be countless times, thousands of times, probably, I've been interviewed. I was never wearing a Hitler mustache when I was in there. I didn't ever salute anybody sticking my arm up into the air. I didn't click my boots, Richie.
No.
I spoke about umpteen things. Passionately, yes, but truthfully, I fought my corner. Sometimes I won, sometimes I lost. But the idea now that these scum who know me, who have known me for half of my life, are going around whispering that I'm some kind of neo-Nazi. That's what you've got. That's what you've come to, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all they can do. That's all they have left. Because they are not journalists anymore. They are journaliers. That's what they are. And I don't mean that purely as an attack, as a rhetorical jibe. I mean it in this precise way, that truth factory has now become a lie factory. Because the truth ceased to be viable for them. Because why? Because they drove away, in the first instance, roughly 50% of their own listeners and viewers, because they were so disgusted, and the readers in the case of
music,
so disgusted at the ideological drifts and shifts that were taking place, and that newspapers, which once were the newspapers of the people, which I, as a mail car driver with my father, who rode the same car for 50 years delivering mails and newspapers around the west of Ireland, we used to think of ourselves as like the king's messengers, out through the kingdom to bring the news from the centre every morning, getting up at 4 o'clock, and with great pride, thinking we are part of our democracy because this is the fourth estate, the messages from the fourth estate, which are now being disseminated throughout the kingdom. And a funny thing, Richie, when I became a journalist in 1981, by joining Hot Press, and I went to Dublin. And I remember my little niece, Elaine, who was only a little girl at the time, and God bless her, she's getting married on this coming weekend.
Oh, brilliant.
She said to me, as a little girl, about four, I think, or something like that, she said, John, which do you prefer, delivering the newspapers or writing in them? And I said, I don't know, you know, I don't know. It's a close call. Because it was. But I'll tell you now, Richie, I have no doubt about it. Delivering them was at least had a bit of dignity about it. Writing them today is the work of rats and slime.
You said they'd be whispering things like Waters is a fascist. I wish that were true. I wish they believed it. Because if they believed it, you could understand it. They don't whisper that Waters is a fascist or O'Doherty is a fascist. They know the opposite is true. This is the thing that I can't get my head around either as somebody who's worked in radio most of his life producing and presenting. I'm not the nicest guy that ever lived. I'm not a hero. I never have been. But I could not go on the air and facilitate lies like that about you or about anybody else. I would rather be unemployed. And I mean that. I couldn't do that.
No. Well, Richie, it's not just about us. I mean, that's one little sideshow.
Yeah.
I mean, look what they've been doing for the past 7 months now, lying, terrorizing the public with lies, which they know to be lies in many, many instances. I admit now, you know, in fairness to them, many of them are stupid and don't know their lies.
Yeah.
Anybody with a scintilla of intelligence knows for the last while that this is complete lies. Look at it now. I'll just give you a comparison in the Irish context. March the 11th was the first alleged death from COVID. And the peak of the deaths occurred, according to the graphs. Now, the graphs are not entirely reliable in Ireland, nor is anything else. But the reason, there's one particular reason why some of them, the fatality rates are not particularly reliable, was that they were holding back deaths to group them so they could create a peak. You see, that became absolutely clear at one point that they were holding back. They were sending away, you know, they were holding back numbers so that they could then release them all together and create a big splash. You see, that was but according to the graphs, April 19th or so was the peak, right? So, and then it came down by the end of the first week in May down to almost, you know, a very normal level. But there's a big long explanation I could go into for why that happened, because most of it happened in nursing homes and it has nothing or little or nothing to do with COVID.
Same here.
But to make the comparison, so that there was a 6 week period, say, between the 11th of March and the 19th of April, which was 6 weeks approximately, in which you would say that the deaths went from zero to their peak. There's another figure here you need to take on board, which is that the time lag between infection and death, where death occurs, is on average deemed to be something about 3 weeks. So that means that when you start getting infections, you will start getting deaths 3 weeks later. And as your infections mount up, your death should be mounting to their peak 3 weeks beyond that, you see.
Yeah.
So that would have meant that, for example, in April, the peak of infections was sometime around the turn of the month from March to April. But the infections in Ireland have been going up now for something like 4 months, if we're to believe this, the authorities, the alleged cases. And they're introducing all kinds of measures, face masks in early July, face masks in shops and cafes and all the rest of it in early August. Here we are nearly in November and deaths are still at statistical zero.
Yeah.
And yet we have the harshest lockdown in the world now. Now you tell me, Richie, and the journalists are looking at this, and not alone are they not telling the public, but they're on Twitter acting like shills for the government.
Yeah, they are, yeah, yeah.
Berating their fellow citizens for not obeying the rules with sufficient adherence and obedience. And this is not the job of journalists. When did it become the job of journalists to act as policemen of their fellow citizens? Their job is to hold power to account. And that's the last thing they're doing. And you see, go back to what I'm talking about. What has actually happened in journalism is quite terrifying in a way, Richie. Because what it is that they have flipped their business model from telling the truth to telling lies. They are being paid now. And you know, they're being paid. And here there's plenty of proof. they're being paid because by advertising and by subsidy, they are being paid, they're being kept on life support by the government.
By the government, yeah.
In order to do precisely that, to precisely so that as to bamboozle the public. And that's where we've left now. I mean, I tell this, you know, there's I watch out the window here. I live in Dunleary, near Dunleary, and there's a couple of people down this the road who still haven't got the message about the media. And there's one particular man, he's a lovely elderly man, and he saunters up the town, like to the shops, to get his paper in the morning about 10:30. And he's his little dog with him. And he comes back 20 minutes later with the Irish Times under his arm, whistling to himself, you know. And I'm thinking of going out and saying to him, listen, Don, you know, that thing is just lies from cover to cover.
From cover to cover.
That you see, this is the point. You see it, Richie, that they, for 160 years, the Irish Times purveyed the truth to the best of its ability every morning. And the masthead of that paper that my father and I used to carry to the shops all over the west of Ireland was the guarantor of the integrity and the authority of this newspaper. And what is actually happening now is literally they are as though breaking up the furniture for firewood. They have sold their soul to the government and to the corporations, to Big Pharma, in return for survival for another few months.
So ironically then, John Waters is our guest, by the way, a favourite journalist of mine and author. Great guy. It's great to have him back on the programme. There's an irony here then, isn't there? Because these organisations are accusing nationalists and patriots, decent people, of being right-wing and fascist. But yeah. Ireland itself has descended into fascism then. It must have done.
Well, exactly right. I mean, there's an old saying, I don't know who said it, about America, you know, that when fascism comes to America, it will be called anti-fascism.
Yeah.
Well, here we are in Ireland. This is exactly what's happening. That the people who are now trying to turn us into Czechoslovakia in 1970, 1968, when the tanks rolled down the streets of Prague, the people who are trying to do this are calling everybody else Nazi and fascist, when in fact all they need to do is look at the finger they're pointing at us and see that there are four other fingers pointing back at them.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know, John. Here we have the Telegraph. It's the only newspaper that's really going for it at the moment. At least we have that. You know, it really is going for it. You know, basically calling the government liars. You have articles saying that the government is lying about the figures of cases in Manchester and the deaths. But yet, the Telegraph, we live in such a polarised world now, and we live in such a narcissistic society, that rather than read stuff like that, people have divided themselves into so many subcategories. You know, I'm alt-right, I'm alt-left, oh, I'm Momentum, oh, I'm a Corbynite, oh, I'm a Corbynista. Rather than look at that, people will say, Telegraph, right-wing newspaper, load of bollocks, not going to read it. So they're doing their job, but nobody's reading it.
Well, you know, yeah, it's true. It's true.
Ironically.
The Spectator has been reasonably good, I think, over the period, over the full reach of the period. Dr. John Lee has written a number of articles in that, and they have been really excellent along the last, going right back to last April. No, that is absolutely true. You know, you see, there's something very strange about this, Richie. I mean, I as I've told you before, I was, you know, initially, I don't like these terms left and right so much. You know, I think that we react humanly to whatever is in front of us.
I agree.
And if the people, you know, in front of us are right wing, then if we're threatening us, then we're going to call ourselves left wing. And if they're left wing, we're probably going to be called right wing. That's inevitable. But I recently met up with an old friend of mine, going right back to magazines in the 1980s. And we were in left wing magazines, leftish in the sense that they were kind of, that was the natural inclination at that time, because we were coming out of, you know, an Ireland that was kind of quite monochrome, shall we say, and a traditionalist and reactionary to a high degree, and, you know, adult, you know, related as opposed to youth directed.
And yeah.
Maybe we've gone too far in that other direction now. But I was talking to this man, I hadn't seen him for a good few years, and he worked with me in the same magazine way, way back. And he was a left-winger then, and a man of great integrity, you know. And you know, but I was astonished, Richie, to talk to him, because he had no idea about anything that was happening now. He was totally scared of the COVID, was scared of me because I wasn't scared of it.
Right.
And he was still talking about the his pet issue going back, and I'm not disparaging it, Irish neutrality. He was a great fighter on that, the importance of Irish neutrality, protecting, you know, and keeping Ireland out of alliances with other foreign organizations or nations. He opposed to things like, you know, American fighter planes or whatever stopping at Shannon Airport, things like that. A highly, you know, ethical and very important stance. But Richie, right now where we are, Irish neutrality is only one of a menu of issues that will be of grave concern in the future. It's way down the list.
Of course it is.
It's subsumed by the greater issue that Irish freedom and Irish sovereignty as issues, as fundamentals, are under threat. And he didn't know. He didn't know, Richie. He had no idea, because he's been reading the Irish Times and he's been watching RTE. He has no clue what's going on in his own country anymore. And he thinks I'm crazy because I'm telling him this is going on. And you see, I can't go too far with people like that because there's too much. There's an overload that you get into. Within 5 minutes, you know their eyes glaze over because they can't take it in.
And you get irate. You could get irate then. And then you find yourself getting louder. And
that's right.
It doesn't work. Right. I've seen it's happened to me so many times with people. Let me just remind our listeners, 26 minutes to the top of the hour. John Waters is our guest. John is going to be with me till around about 5 to 7, just before we close out the programme. You know all about John. There's no need for me to give you his CV again. We've been talking about what's been happening in Ireland. It's under full lockdown now till Christmas. The economic devastation, the health devastation with real health issues for people, for their, obviously their psychological well-being. Unimaginable, really, what's happening in our country. And you've got this kind of civil war then that is being stoked by this disgusting media and stoked by politicians, where people who are asking genuine questions, are asking for evidence, are asserting their sovereignty, their rights as citizens of Ireland, as patriots, ask these questions, are being demonised and labelled as fascists and far-right thugs and all this garbage. We've covered a lot of ground. I'm going to tell you where I am, and then I'll shut up and get out of your way again. I think we're fucked. I really do. I don't see enough people having the courage. And I feel very embarrassed saying that to you, because you've actually done things. You've actually got off your arse and challenged it. You, Gemma O'Doherty and others, other Irish people I've had on the programme, Fiona Marie Flanagan, others, you've gotten off your arse. And you've shamed people who haven't. You've shamed guys like me who just make radio programmes. But still, I think we are fecked. And I want a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. How are we going to stop it, John? What can we do? I mean, is there anything we can do at this stage?
Oh, gosh, Richie, that's a big one. Well, I mean, first of all, we need briefly to sketch in what we think is coming, you know. And I mean, we have a fair idea from the information that's coming out of Canada the last couple of weeks, because there was a leak there from a parliamentary operation there, and it was from a concerned politician who saw the blueprint for the next year in Canada, which involves like isolation camps. It involves the confiscation of property, the write-off of debts in exchange for that confiscation of property, and all kinds of measures which are absolutely terrifying. They are actually plain fascist totalitarianism, without question. That's what it is. Now, I say that with a part of me holding out, Richie, because I'm a man who grew up in this country, this beautiful country, and read his Orwell when he was a young fellow. And was greatly inspired to become a journalist myself by George Orwell. And, you know, I read those books with a sort of a smirk on my face, Richie, you know, in a certain sense, a metaphorical sense, that I was kind of saying, well, haha, you know, those poor bastards, like, that'll never happen here, you know?
Yeah.
That couldn't happen here, could it, Richie? Could it happen in our beautiful country? No, it couldn't. It's impossible. And yet here we are. The tanks are rolling down the street now. It's like Prague 68, isn't it? Metaphorically still, but not far off the litter. And that's where we're looking at. That's what we're looking at now. And You mentioned the question of Shane. Oh, you've done a wonderful job, Richie, and I congratulate you and thank you for it. And you've had such wonderful people on, including the great Dr. Vernon Coleman, like, who was a tremendous, solace and to us all, and encouragement to us all in these dark times. But you used the word shame as you were speaking there. And I mean, as I'm saying to you, it in no way applies to you. But it's an interesting thing. And I've noticed this now, and it's very interesting. You know, I remember there's a line somewhere from Páraic Pearce, the great Irish revolutionary, where he talks about Ireland as a woman, you know. And he used a phrase in one, I think it was the coming revolution. And he said, she needs men. She needs men. Well, that's our problem, Richie. Because there are no men left in Ireland now, or very few. Now they're maybe there, hidden out there in the bushes somewhere. But I've noticed now it's very interesting. Since myself and Gemma lodged our papers in April, and it became known through the so-called media, we were being, of course, the media immediately, they did the dog whistle thing, and they basically set the entire, as many people as they could, upon us. And that's, because I'm more recognizable, I get it. And I've been getting it now in the streets for 6 months. Now, it eased off a little bit in the summer, but it's come back with a bit of a vengeance in the last couple, in last week or 10 days, because the thing is now in the news again, you see. And it's, and the very, I want to just to give you a profile of it. One of the things that's been happening here, which you wouldn't imagine would have happened during the pandemic, is that they've been building huge, which brings us back to the Great Reset and all the rest of it, cycle lanes. Half of our road now is devoted to cycle lanes. Yeah, there's only one lane for traffic, and it's just about wide enough for an average-sized car. Another car will have to climb up on the footpath to get down. And there's every 10 seconds here outside my window, a cyclist in Lycra, a male usually in Lycra. And when I go down the street, Richie, when I see a man coming at me with blue overalls and a wrench sticking up out of his pocket, I know there's 100% certainty that he's not going to say anything nasty to me.
Yeah,
but if I see a buck coming on a bike in Lycra, there's about a 50-50 chance he's going to let fly a stream of experience. So, watershed, so and so. Yeah, mind your own business. Look after your own business. No, all that. Now, I, for a while, was simply taking this. Now, obviously, the obvious thing is that they're being set up. I'm being baited by the media. They're being baited by the media against this. But I started thinking about it more deeply, and it's what you said. It's shame. It's shame. It's emasculation. You see, these men are men who are not longer allowed to be men. We've had 30, 40 years of feminine nasties shouting at them names, you know, demonizing them. And now this is the culmination of that whole process, I think. I was on top of that. I didn't know I was over the target back in the mid-90s. I didn't even know there was a target. But now I see the whole connection. Now, what was beginning to happen then, I was talking about family law cases and male suicide and the attacks on men, the relentlessness on advertising and all that, attacks on men day after day, hour after hour. And now these men are completely cuckolded. By the state. And you see what happens when they see me, there's a chance to redeem themselves. Because it's like the old game of Conquerors, Richie. Yeah, you know, when you were in school, like you had your Conquerors in your pocket and you'd have like a 20 killer because you'd have broken, the other
thing, like, 20 you know? Other Conquerors,
and,
yeah.
You see, and you were the one they all wanted to take on, you see?
Yeah.
Because if they could take your Conqueror, they had your 20 as well as whatever they had already. And that's the syndrome that I'm facing. Because when they see Waters walking down the street, they let this, that gives them a sense of relief from the shame they feel and from the sense of emasculation they feel. And I think that's probably the most fundamental thing that's happened in this whole thing. This sense of, you know, that it is that men who would fight it have been subdued because, you see, they can't feed their families anymore. They can't be breadwinners. They can't even bring their kids in the back of the car to the beach on a sunny day because some band garda will stop them and tell them go home in front of their children. You see? So they're totally shamed. This is kind of... So men, you see, we need men. Pearce had it then and it's still true. 100 years ago, 2020.
You were right. You were writing about this stuff in the 90s and I don't think we had you on, but my presenter, God rest him, Billy McCarthy. We had a big debate one time, 99 or 2000, about what was happening to real men. Honest to God. And now we hear a term used a lot called toxic masculinity. And I like to think that back in the late 70s, early 80s, I knew a lot of trade unionists through Waterford Crystal. I mean, I don't mean then. I mean, I was very, very young then. But as I got into my teens in the late 80s and in the 90s, I got to know a lot of trade unionists and, you know, guys who were definitely on the left. And they wouldn't have put up with any of this. But you're right, something happened. And it led to men being told that they have to be in touch with their feelings. Now, this is only one tiny aspect of it, but that we have to admit, yeah, we have to admit that we have, you know, mental problems and psychological problems. We've got to open up and all this bollocks. And then I saw men wearing bags, shoulder bags, like man bags. Then I saw men wearing makeup. This is no joke, in Boots in Manchester and Market Street. I've seen men get makeup. And I remember The Sopranos is a very interesting television show. The lead character is a psychopath. He's a mafia guy. He's not a redeemable character. But it's a great line in the show, John, when he's driving with one of his henchmen through the woods some night, and he says, what happened to the strong, silent type? What happened to Gary Cooper? He said, you know, what's happening to men? He said. And well, you're right, men. Where are men? What does it mean to be masculine today? Can you be masculine?
Well, I'll tell you something. One of the things, when I'm walking around the place now and I sit down maybe outside a cafe and there's a couple of men nearby, and I hear the chattering of these fellas now, and they're like women. It's almost young fellas now. They're talking gibberish.
Yeah.
About going to the gym or something like that. Like, it's complete mindless gibberish. You don't hear sober, solid men like my father's and his friends that used to sit talking about affairs of state.
Yeah, and the game on Sunday. Like, yeah.
And that's gone. And you see, you mentioned the concept of toxic masculinity. See, that's a complete trick that is played on men, because what they're calling toxic masculinity now is actually the consequence, the result of the intimidation that happened 30 years ago. Because what they actually did, they cut men off from their own, from their role models, from their fathers. They made them fearful of their fathers, make them despise their fathers, so they didn't have a proper role model. And what happened, as Robert Bly has kind of described so eloquently, is that when you don't have a father, a male figure who can allow you to show you how to be a man, you cling to your mother. And you are given between a choice between having female feelings, which is the only option, and or no feelings. Men tend to choose no feelings. And that's why you have so many men now who are, I don't call them toxic masculinity, I call it macho man. A macho man is not an exaggerated male in the sense that he's overly male. He's actually a man who is trying to compensate for the fact that he doesn't know how to be a man.
Yeah.
He has never had a role model. And they've actually created this concept of toxic masculinity, not just a name, but in a certain sense, the condition. Because a toxic masculine male is actually a man who has spent too much time under the influence of women.
Yeah.
And they've done that to almost every man now, not just in that way that I've described, by cutting them off from the fathers, but in the education system, where, you know, about 80% of the teachers, right up to the second level, end of second level, are female. So boys have no male figure. Most boys grow up to be 18 or 19, and unless their father is a particularly strong-minded, clear-minded man who has understood a lot of things, they don't actually have a father who is present and useful in their growth as men.
Do you know what's happening in primary schools here in this country? I bet it's happening in the UK, in Ireland as well. Every animal in the animal kingdom, every animal, every fish, the male chases the female, woos the female, courts the female. Kids are being told in school now that they can't ask a girl out on a date. They can't ask a girl anything like that. They can't get into any sort of a discussion like that with a girl because this Me Too thing, it'll be harassment. I know when I was at, when I first started at WLR, there was talk that companies all over Ireland were introducing day training courses to tell the men in the companies that they couldn't ask their female colleagues for a cup of coffee or for a drink. And I remember we talked about this on the radio, and I used to meet my ex-colleagues, because I used to be a tour guide at Waterford Crystal when I was in my teens, and I used to meet all these old guys that were glass blowers, proper men, you know, real men, and they would say, Jesus, Richie, all of us in the factory, we got married to a girl that we met in the factory. You know what I mean? They're telling youngsters now that it's an assault of sorts to woo a female, and I'm not being exaggerative here, this is a fact, John. What's going on? I don't know how they're getting away with this.
I'm aware of this, I mean, even if there isn't an explicit rule, many men have that terror, because the overall culture, the outside, the external culture is so hostile to them and is looking for something to indict, some charge to indict them on. And therefore, I mean, you know yourself that this very process is prone to, there's a risk factor in it.
Of course.
The male risks being rebuffed, and sometimes rebuffed quite emphatically. But that's the joy of it, in a way, that if you're not rebuffed, then there's the idea of that you have been able to make, or even if you are rebuffed, at least you've made the effort.
Yeah.
At least you've had the courage to ask. And you see, the problem is, when you don't have that, then you don't have anything. You know, nothing happens then at all, or it happens surreptitiously, or it happens anyway, despite all the rules and regulations. But I think, you see, this is we need to look very closely. If we ever get out of this spot we're in now, we need to pull the whole thing apart and start looking at it. Going back, I think, I would say going back to the 70s. First of all, I think the first episode was the feminists, the extreme radical feminists, who started to demonize men, all men, as rapists and all the rest of it.
For being men.
And they need to be indicted for that and told, shut up. You have destroyed our culture, because this is where it has brought us to. Because the same ingredients can be seen at the back of this whole COVID thing. It's essentially the same model, what is called culture and Marxism, you know. It's essentially, and you can see the breakdowns in the same way. It's very interesting. You wouldn't have thought, you see, Richie, that something to do with a pandemic, something to do with health, would actually result in a breakdown left-right, say. But if you look on Twitter and see the voices that were the pro-government shills, they're almost exclusively the people that would turn up on certain issues, pro-LGBT, pro-abortion, pro-mass migration, unquestioned mass migration. They're the same people. And the people who are answering them are people who simply, in my opinion, express commonsensical, unexceptionable views about the right of a people to determine their own destiny and their own future.
Without being called a bunch of thugs and racists. We've had a very good tweet, by the way. We've had a very good tweet. Very early on in the conversation, John talked about people being bussed in from the north of Ireland, Antifa people being paid to start fights at the anti-mask protests. I obviously asked John, did he have any definitive proof of that? John was patient with me and said, don't be naive, fair enough. There is an article in The Guardian, The Observer. Now, it's going back. Let me see when it goes back. This is good stuff now. This goes back to 2009. G20 police used undercover men to incite the crowds. Brake, former Lib Dem MP, saw plainclothes police officers going through a police cordon. These guys were agent provocateurs. They were sent in to make people protesting against globalism, to make them look violent. So, there's previous, and I knew that as well.
You've reminded me of a thing. I mean, one of the things that happened in the last summer, myself and Gemma organised what we call Bunrocht on the beach. Bunrocht is the Irish word for the Irish constitution, Bunrocht na hÉireann. And we did this thing to kind of raise consciousness about the constitution and the importance of it. And I would, read for the constitution and give a speech about different aspects of it. But we were everywhere we went, we were set upon by these thugs. And I remember one night in Athlone, a man came up to me afterwards, as the crowd was still there, the thugs were still there. And he said to me, he was an ex-policeman. And he said, he started pointing out the number of the thugs. He said, look, he's wearing an earpiece.
Wow.
You see, this is, and I said, yeah, oh, Yes, he was. He said, this is all, this is, guards have organized this. There's a van over there. They're issuing instructions from over there.
Do these guards not know, John? Do these guards not know? And this makes me fucking sick. And I've actually said this to police officers here in Manchester. I have. I've been polite, obviously. Do they not know that there are laboratories run in companies in the United States of America that have their replacements and they are robots? They are robots. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the name of the company. There's a very famous company. They're ready to go. What the fuck, excuse me language again, do these guards think they're going to do? What are they going to do then? Are they going to stand with John Waters then? Is it going to be too late then?
It'll be too late then, Richie. You see, this is the thing I would say to them. You know, what about, don't you have children? I used to say to women, you know, back in the feminists who were shouting at me, don't you have any sons? Well, now I would say, do you have sons or daughters? Do you have grandchildren? Do you think where, because, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound melodramatic, Richie. I'm not, I stopped myself there. I was going to say, I don't want to be melodramatic. But in fact, I don't know if you could actually describe reality anymore without seeming to be melodramatic. But I'm saying this is the worst thing that's ever happened in our country in my lifetime, and for a long time before it. That if even half of what we're now being told about what's happening and what the plan is comes to pass, the life we will have afterwards will not be worth living.
No,
that's what I'm telling people. That they will take away every little joy, every little pleasure, every little freedom, anything that people enjoy. You know, I said it last night or the other night on Dave Cullen's stream, you know, that here we are, a situation now where an elderly woman in a village in the west of Ireland who manages to get out of bed, maybe 82, 83 years of age, and make her way across the village to her best friend. And they sit for a half an hour drinking a cup of coffee. And I defend her right to do that. I defend her right to have that pleasure. That makes me a neo-Nazi now, yeah, in RTE terms.
And her a criminal.
That's what we come to, yes, and her a criminal. You see, like, so I cannot stress sufficiently to people that it is, even at this late hour, would you please turn off your television, take up your laptop if you have one, call your niece or your nephew. Ask them, do they have a laptop? Can they find your YouTube? Look up things. Look up the name Klaus Schwab. KLAUSSCHWAB. He's the chairman of the World Economic Forum. Read about that man. Read about that man. Look at him. What does he remind you of?
Yeah.
What does his voice remind you of? What does his thoughts, what do his thoughts remind you of? Read about the Canadian leak that happened a week ago. Read this stuff. Listen to people. Listen to Dr. Vernon Coleman. Go on to YouTube.
Brand YouTube.
Yes, he's on there. Watch these people. Listen to them. You've had him on. But I despair of people. You know, it's, see, one of the things, I think I've talked about this before, to Richie, but what they've actually done here is a form of mass entrancement, and this is something we don't know anything about. Why? Because the people who are doing it are the people who we also depend on to tell us what's going on. Right. So obviously they're not any more than Tommy Cooper was going to tell you how he does his tricks. They're not going to tell you how they do this. But this is really literally a form of hypnosis that is bypassing people's reason. The use of language and imagery on and the repetition and emotional manipulation through television and radio and newspapers is actually causing people to be terrorized and to have to bypass their own reason, so they're not able to absorb the truth about this. And what they need to do is to detox from all that media for a few days and then go into the factual thing. There's any number of doctors and scientists out there. You'll find them on YouTube.
Thousands.
You know, Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg, Dr. Sucharat Bhakti, Dr. Shiva Aradurai, Dr. Rashid Buttar, Dr. John Lee, Dr.
Martin Kulldorff from Harvard University, the great Barrington doctors, there's thousands. I've just got to say, we've got about 90 seconds. I'm going to give you the 90. We've got 90 seconds before we're going to wrap it up today. I love having you on. Do come back before Christmas. Do come back before Christmas. I said that to Stephen in the first hour as well, but I'd love to have you back on before Christmas, John. So if you can make the time to do that, we can do a full 2 hours. But we've got 90 seconds. I know you were wrapping up there, but I just want to remind you. I'll give you the absolute final word on it. 90 seconds. And okay. Powerful stuff, mate, tonight. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Richie. Okay, well, what I will say to finish is this, that we grew up believing that we were moving forward, progress, and that we had already an imperfect democratic system, but we were going to improve it and make it better and better. It never dawned on us that totalitarianism might be possible. That was something that had to be, if it existed at all for us, it was a possibility that existed in the past. But what has happened now, Richie, is very interesting, because all of the advances in technology with big data and big tech and the capacity to spy on people and retain information about them and control people's lives, as the Chinese have perfected with their social credit systems and so on, and watch people and penalize people for breaking taboos or breaches of, you know, not for criticizing the government, you can lose your right to travel, for example, all that kind of stuff. And what that opens up is a very frightening thought. Richie, that only has occurred to me in the recent few days, that actually all these people all the time, whether they were politicians, intellectuals, philosophers, artists, writers, poets, who espoused the virtues of democracy, and they're all silent now, even as this happens, even as the tanks roll down the street, that actually what they were actually doing was that it wasn't so much that they were principled in favor of democracy, but that they were, we didn't have any tools available. They didn't have the tools to actually do something different. And now that they have the tools, they're intent upon doing it. It's a bit like the kind of gag that I used to, you know, years ago say, you know, about the Irish people that in the past, like they used to be non-materialistic, like up to the time of the Celtic Tiger. And I used to say, well, no, they weren't. They just had no money, you know. And it's the same principle that these people, they weren't really Democrats at all. They just didn't have the tools to become fascists. But now they have. And that's what they're doing. That's what's happening. And people need to see
They need to see it. They need to disengage from the television and from the newspapers they read. John, thanks for coming back on, mate. I know you were otherwise engaged around the country this week, but you've given us your time tonight, and I really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back before Christmas.
I'd love to, Richie. Thank you. Anytime. I'd love to, you know, and thank you so much for everything. I think it's great that there are some people, some voices out there still of sanity and truth. And I pay you great tribute. You know, don't be in any way feeling that you have not contributed. Boy, have you contributed. It's been fantastic.
You're kind to say that. You're very kind. You mentioned Dave Cullen earlier on. There's lots of independent content creators out there that are providing the platform for the alternative. They deserve all the credit as well. Godspeed, mate. I look forward to speaking to you again real soon. And thanks for coming back tonight. The great John Waters on the Richie Allen Radio Show. If you haven't read any of John's books, I've put links out on Twitter to where you can read him. Great, great Irish journalist of yore. Can't say enough about him. Thanks to Stephen Lenman, our 1-2. That's it. We've gone over, but I'll chop it up because getting a lot of listeners listening on the stream, basically 24 hours a day. So we'll chop it up for a 2-hour edit. And I'll be back with you, I suppose, on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock UK time, where we'll have the Sunday View thing, the newspapers and all the rest of that. Thanks, Stephen Lenman. Thanks, John Waters. You have a fantastic weekend. Speak to you really soon. Bye for now. Bye now.